The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 9. Fighting Back. They couldn't destroy the locket, and that was a thing. But since they had found a Horcrux without leaving the house, everybody was feeling quite optimistic. Besides, it is not that they couldn't destroy it per se, it was that the only available method, fiendfire, was extremely dangerous, and they agreed they probably shouldn't attempt it inside the house. It also gave them a good clue to continue the search. Voldemort had now used a personal item, a family heirloom, and a relic from Salazar Slytherin himself. There was a theme. Every day they considered fiendfire. Every day they went down to the kitchens, which were underground and had stone walls, and every day they abandoned the idea. Fiendfire could destroy a Horcrux, because fiendfire could and would destroy anything and everything. They weren't just risking dying in a fire, they were risking burning down the whole street. Fiendfire was a no, but the kitchen seemed like a good place to try destroying a Horcrux, good solid stones and iron all around. They thought about it, and they decided that it would be safe to try something else, so they brought down the big cauldron. More than 300 years old and made of solid iron, it was a mean and heavy thing, rarely used nowadays. A remnant from the times when magic was wild and everything required an extra punch. They brought the cauldron from its crook and they settled it in the fire. 1/3 full of water left to boil for a whole day, with the three of them taking turns to make sure the fire didn't die and the water didn't dry. Then another 1/3 of the cauldron was filled with oil, and now it would have to bubble for 2 whole days. They put mittens over mittens and got a leather apron so they could get very close to the cauldron. The 3rd section was pure bleach. They tied scarves to their faces and worked really quick adding the ingredients and fueling the fire, because setting foot in the kitchen was becoming difficult. Thank Merlin that Harry could conjure sandwiches if he tried hard enough, because the place had no proper ventilation and there was no way anyone could cook in there. The door to the garden was open, but it did little to send breathable air to the kitchen below. The brew boiled for 3 more days. The next part had to be done very carefully and very precisely, which was difficult when you could not breathe inside the room and your eyes watered as soon as you got close to the cauldron. The key was to work in a chain, preparing the ingredients in the stairs and doing a sort of relay race. The seeds of the African violet couldn't be outside their pod for more than 50 seconds before losing their effect. Hermione opened the pod with swift fingers, she had no gloves, and dropped them on Harry's waiting hands, 2 pairs of gloves. Harry, who was small and very fast, ran to the cauldron and dropped the seeds. Just as he was coming back to the stairs to take a breath, Draco ran past him to add the goat milk. Harry cut the hairs from spiders' legs, and Hermione went to add them to the brew while Draco sweated and cursed his way through distilling pure alcohol from a single blueberry. Hermione's blood was waiting in a crystal vial. It was amazing how many of these recipes required virgin blood or woman's blood at the very least. Harry thought that gender shouldn't make much difference, but since they had Hermione with them, they could just as well use the real deal. She said she didn't mind. The blood was the last. As soon as the 3 droplets fell into the potion, the mixture stopped bubbling and went still and crystal clear, like a pond where angels would bathe. This lasted for 15 seconds before turning to look like the hellish concoction it really was. The brew emitted a rotten, acrid smell that made their eyes water and their noses run. They were all sweating, and yet their clothes felt like too little protection. Their skin crawled and their hair was bristling. The brew stirred by itself, turning around looking for something to devour, to burn, to melt and destroy down to its very molecules. And there was a reason why this particular recipe was kept in a locked book, even in a house like the Black's. The potion would devour anything that entered in contact with it until its hunger was satisfied. And for that to happen, it had to eat a living thing.
"All right, creature, come in," said Harry. "Take a deep breath."
It had to be creature. The elf was changing. As much as he despised Hermione and her muggleness, for the last 2 weeks he had served her bacon for breakfast on Sundays. He was still insolent with Harry, but there was something almost like comfort and trust there. Insolence doesn't come easily to a house elf. It had to be creature. The elf was swaddled in wool and leather. He had fought and cried, but Draco had insisted that these were not clothes. No one would consider them so. "Be quiet and give me your arm, we can't have you burning." Draco had wrapped him so much and so tightly that the poor elf could barely move. He looked, in fact, like a horrid newborn, like one of those stories of changelings, an ugly baby bound and wrapped with cloth. Harry took him in his arms and ran straight to the cauldron and the noxious cloud of vapors.
He would have yelled at Creature one last instruction, but they really couldn't open their mouths, and the bubble of the potion was so loud he probably wouldn't have heard, even in Harry's arms. He didn't need to, in any case. As soon as he arrived to the cauldron, Creature extended a stick-thin arm, made slightly wider by the 7 layers of cloth, and dropped the locket inside. Harry didn't stay to see what happened. He ran back, his lungs burning for air. Hermione and Draco were waiting to conjure a magic door and seal the entrance after them, since the kitchen had no door to speak of, just the stairs. Even behind the protective spells and the leather that covered his head, Harry could hear the piercing, inhuman shriek as a piece of Voldemort's soul started to melt in an acid bath. There was a heart beating madly, and Harry couldn't tell if it was Creature's or his own. Eventually, they went upstairs. Listening to a fragment of a soul being destroyed loses the novelty and interest after a while. They abandoned their place by the magic door where they had stood in something almost like reverential silence and went back to the library. There they took off their clothes and picked up the things they had used to prepare the ingredients and generally started to pick up after themselves after 5 days of almost slobbery. The floor of the library was hot from whatever was going on underneath. They all had sore throats even though they had hardly spoken a word, and their noses were red. Draco forbid Creature from going back to the kitchen until they made sure that it was safe. You never knew it, the poor elf. He liked his routines. He could just dive back into the infernal circle they had created in the kitchen and sleep in his usual place. But Creature had stopped talking, and he was trembling, his gaze lost. He didn't even lash out at Hermione when she put a tentative hand on his shoulder and directed him to the little nest of cushions they had made him. He would not sit on a chair or a couch, but he would take the cushions on the floor. The floor was hot, and they could still hear some faint, high notes. They moved further up to the bedrooms on the third floor. That night they all piled up in Hermione's bed, that used to be Draco's and used to be Sirius's, because it had started to dawn on them that they had destroyed a Horcrux with a cleaning potion. Whether it was intended to remove grime or pesky people from your life, it didn't say in the book. Not only that, they had brewed the potion, and then they had let a house elf do the honors. You can't be alone when you do something like that. One is bound to cry and giggle hysterically for a little bit and call the gods. They went back to the kitchen 3 days later, when the floorboards on the ground floor started to cool. They removed the spells and let the room air for the duration of the morning before finally stepping in. So the Horcrux had been destroyed. There was no doubt of that. The 300-year-old iron cauldron was gone, and so was the kitchen itself, where they had started the fire. The stone structure and the iron grate for the fire all gone. All there was in its place was a translucent hard substance and a small piece of iron that they thought may have been part of the cauldron's handle. Creature had a fit. They thought he was going to die. He saw the kitchen. He saw the crystallized goo, and he started to bawl. It wasn't about the kitchen, though. It was about finally completing the task his beloved master had given him. It was about finally being able to rest after 16 years. The elf cried and cried, and then passed out, and Draco had to carry him upstairs to the nest in the library. They were all hungry. Harry sang the magpie song, and then the song about the queen with red pajamas, and he got them a tray of sandwiches and a plate of fruit. He could do better than that, and had done for the past few days, but they were all tired and feeling drained.
Bagshot, magical historian, attacked. 3 unidentified undesirables assaulted the house of Miss Bagshot in Godric's Hollow. Goyle to receive special commendation for services rendered. By Gavinius Rode.
The renowned magical historian and author of Hogwarts A History, Matilda Bagshot, 124, suffered a most foul attack from 3 unidentified wizards suspected to belong to a radical muggle-friendly platform. The 3 wizards gained access to Miss Bagshot's house and subjected her to an interrogation, no doubt wishing to identify and acquire some of the very valuable wizarding artifacts that the historian keeps in her house.
"They brought pastries,"
said Miss Bagshot to this reporter. "A good chance to remind the public that these kinds of undesirable activists will often adopt deceivingly sweet natures in order to take advantage of the natural, agreeable disposition of pure-blood wizards and witches. Mrs. Bagshot was spared from a terrible fate by the fortunate intervention of Mr. Goyle, 41, who happens to be nearby, and together with 2 other wizards who asked to remain anonymous, immediately rushed to the aid of the beloved historian. Mr. Goyle and his companions bravely engaged the undesirables in combat, attempting to draw them out of the house and away from Miss Bagshot. Yet another proof of the barbarism of these people, the undesirables resisted arrest violently and caused multiple injuries before fleeing the place. Mr. Bowcripple, a neighbor of Miss Bagshot of many years, tells us a chilling testimony of the savagery with which the undesirables conducted themselves.
One of the young ones stabbed one of the men in the armpit. I didn't know you could do that with a wand.
A further example that the Muggle usurpers do not understand the use of a magic wand, since they gained access to them through illegitimate means. Tobias Scamander of the Scamander family was visiting Mr. Beau Crimkle, and he adds that, I thought it was some sort of art performance at first. I enjoyed the part when the big one was turned into an icicle. We must be grateful for the good work of the Ministry wizards and witches who, under the direction of Pious Thickness, are working tirelessly to protect our society from the threat of Muggle and Muggle-friendly hate. Hopefully, Mr. Goyle and his companions will heal soon from the injuries sustained in the line of duty. Goyle will be honored later this week with a special commendation for his effort to protect wizarding culture and the elderly members of our community. This journalist reminds its readers to exert caution and keep vigilant for any signs of Muggle violence.
If Voldemort was clearly following a theme in his choice of objects to turn into Horcruxes, toddlers notwithstanding, the location to store them was less well thought out. There was the ancestral ring hidden in his family home, which was thematically connected, yes, but although the locket had been hidden under very powerful and nasty security measures, the place itself seemed to be some random cave. No matter how they looked at it, it had no relation with Salazar Slytherin at all. Matilda Bagshot had been quite certain Slytherin came from the Fen, and although scholars disagreed if that meant Norfolk or Lincolnshire or Ireland, what was certain is that it was not the cave creature had described. And then his prized diary had been left under the care of Lucius Malfoy, who went to hand and used it for his own political gain. So the Horcruxes were symbolic, and they now had a pretty good idea of what to look for, thanks to the friendly and helpful Bagshot. But there was no rhyme or reason, none whatsoever, to their placement. Which is why they were now on their field trip number 8, visiting the meadow where Rowena Ravenclaw got to second base with Helga Hufflepuff or something like that. Hermione snorted. She looked surprised at her laughter. "The forest where Nimue trapped Merlin," she said, pushing her hair back from her face. Harry got a glimpse of the vivid pink lines in her arm. She'd only stopped wearing bandages 3 weeks ago, and it was less due to trauma and more to the fact that the cuts had only closed then. If Ron were here, he would make her smile more. He was also very good at making her cry, but Ron would make her laugh, and she certainly needed to laugh a bit more. At least, she barely had any nightmares now. Those first 2 months had been really bad. Now, though, now she was sleeping more and eating even better, and it was really good. It was probably the summer and what little closure they got from Dumbledore's death, but mostly it seemed that the best therapy was fighting back. Because they were. They were fighting back, and they were getting out of the house. However, powers of disguise on Harry's part or not, after reading the Prophet, it had become evident that they really shouldn't show themselves in public places. "I can't believe you forgot to pack your invisibility cloak, Harry Potter. You took a comb and not the cloak." "It was a very good comb." This meant no night bus and no flu, unless it couldn't be avoided. They could try apparition, except Hermione had only taken 2 classes, which was too few, and even though Draco was doing a good job with his disposable wands, he felt apparating would be a bit too much. It was, after all, a bunch of ingredients held in his hand, and no one wanted to see Harry try. It was Harry. Not only would he splinch himself, he would probably manage to appear in another dimension. And as Hermione pointed out, they didn't have a license. The first few times, they flew on broomsticks, and Hermione didn't complain, even though it was obvious it terrified her. Harry didn't like it either. He liked flying, but he didn't like that feeling of exposure when they returned to the house, and anyone could be following them. Given how Draco kept glancing back, he had similar thoughts. And then the solution presented itself one Monday afternoon when Creature popped in their bedroom to bring the clean laundry, and popped back away. Creature was an excellent solution for their transport problems, and there was minimum stomach jolting in the process, but a house elf is as powerful as his house, and their magic is limited in strange ways. If creatures stayed with them while they were out, Grimald Place would become vulnerable to all kinds of attacks and invasions. Not that anyone was attacking them at the moment, but the house would be more visible, so to speak. It could drift back into the minds of certain people. So Creature only left the house for minutes at a time to drop them somewhere and later pick them up. This was fine. It avoided going through crowds, and they went directly to the areas of interest they wanted to explore. They even had a picnic basket for the day.
"I always had the impression that Merlin must have been insufferable," said Draco suddenly, while they all looked for promising Horcrux hiding spots. "One of those people who must always correct you, and gave his opinion to every single thing you're doing. But then it turns out his advice isn't that good. And he spoke without really understanding what you were doing, and when you point it out, he insists that you didn't understand, and tell you something else that is equally useless."
Hermione and Harry stared bemusedly at Draco.
"I would trap him under a rock, too," he finished.
They were about to say something, answer Draco, and joke about his ridiculously detailed opinions on historical figures based on absolutely nothing.
"I don't think Helga Hufflepuff ever wore underwear. She strikes me as the kind of lady who wouldn't. And I bet Giovanni di Mantua was gay. Look at this picture and tell me I'm wrong."
It was good. It was sunny. There was the smell of summer in the air. And they were still riding the success of the locket and the visit to Bagshot. They were all feeling optimistic. And that's when they heard a raspy female voice scream with clear enunciation the words Avada Kedavra. The world didn't appreciate enough the gift to humanity in general, and to the wizarding world in particular, that was Draco Malfoy. No, no, don't laugh. This was serious. Draco Malfoy was a gift, even if he sadly had to say so himself. First, the whole speech about Gryffindor bravery was a big load of hippogriff manure. Gryffindors weren't brave. They were reckless to the point of suicidal stupidity, and it was up to Draco to ensure their continual survival. They heard someone casting the killing curse, and what was their reaction? Why, they dropped the basket and ran in that direction without a second thought. That wasn't brave, that was stupid. You should give second, third, and fourth thoughts, and approach the place discreetly, and checking that you didn't get your exit cut. The basic, let's make sure this is not a trap instinct that Draco thought everybody was born with, but apparently not. Honestly, Harry he could understand, but he expected better of Hermione. Then there was the fact that as charming as Harry was, he really shouldn't be considered a wizard. Now, Draco had witnessed some of the things Harry could do firsthand, but he seriously doubted they could be considered magic. In fact, most of the wonderful things Harry did seemed to go against all known magic, like refusing to die from the killing curse twice, and conjuring food in whole houses, not to speak of him crossing magical, unsurpassable barriers simply because he was very focused on a song. That wasn't a thing, and it shouldn't have worked. Harry wasn't a wizard. What he did was closer to miracles than anything else, and Draco wouldn't be surprised if he turned out to be the reincarnation of some old forest god that spent his time eating apples and playing the flute. As a wizard, though, he was still on a first-year level, and he really, really, really shouldn't run to engage the murderous Death Eaters. He should listen to Draco when he caught a handful of his shirt and told him to wait and think about it. The forest went down in a gentle slope to a lake below, and the voices came from that direction. They creeped that way until they saw the place where the fight had begun. The killing curse had hit a tree, and it had been cast with such force that the centennial tree had died, its leaves falling and its bark becoming dry and brittle and white. Hermione touched one of the lower branches with the fingers of her left hand, she was extra careful with her dominant hand, and stared with big eyes as it dissolved into dust. Such hate, such strength in the kill. The woman with the raspy voice screamed again. Her words were fainter in the distance, but the horrified screams that followed them were loud and clear. Screams of pain, even though they hadn't been hit by her curse. Screams at seeing a comrade fall. And again, they tried to run, and again Draco, wonderful gift to the world that he was, stopped them. Draco knew they were actually quite competent in combat despite their youth and alternative style. The incident at Miss Bagshot's had proven they could hold their ground quite well. They merely needed a good strategy and better control of their emotions, which unfortunately is not something teenagers are known for. Plus, Harry needed quite a lot of time to focus on his music before he could do his thing. Draco wouldn't presume to be the best strategist, but he certainly had admirable self-control. Considering he had inner meltdowns because people put the butter knife on the table rather than a dish, or because they were wearing the wrong color combination, or because they yawned without covering their mouths. Die, Zachariah Smith, die, die, die. The fact that he kept said meltdowns internal spoke of his fantastic restraint. After almost 5 full years in Hogwarts, Draco had still managed not to strangle Justin Finch-Fletchley, and his pompous and erroneous French pronunciation, so really, Draco was temperance in the flesh. They took a minute to think, some of them well pressed to the ground under Draco's body to stop them from running, and he would like to say it was only Harry, but he had to tackle Granger to the ground too and sit on top of both of them, and by doing so, they avoided being killed right away. At first glance, it may look like it was just the woman and 3 other wizards chasing a few people down the hill, but no, it was 7 Death Eaters doing the chasing, not 4. Death Eaters only come in a single group when they are very sure of themselves. After Dalahov's downfall, everybody had leaned to look over their shoulder, and they had learned to spread out to avoid ambushes. Hermione was becoming a tough and hardened witch, or perhaps she'd always been like that, and they had been too distracted by the hair to notice. Hermione was the first to see the body, and she quickly bit the palm of her hands to shut down the scream. He had fallen face down on the earth. He had fallen, and everyone kept moving, running for their lives or running after them, but he was dead and unmoving, and it was as if his murderers didn't care. His companions probably did, but they had been robbed of the chance to mourn. If they fought with the Death Eaters now, they had to win. There was no other option. They had to win or stay alive until dinner time, when Creature would come for them. It would be easier to hide and simply wait until they had left. It would be easier and safer and more sensible in the long run. Fighting and destroying Horcruxes was way more important than saving a handful of hapless lives. But he had fallen face down in the earth and the grass, and his murderers cared so little about him that they didn't even desecrate his body. They moved on to the next victim, the next hunt. They just left him there as if he didn't matter. Today was hot and sunny, and it was going to be full of death. Hermione gave Harry a hair tie and waved them off to go save the people in front, while she took care of the 3 stragglers in the rear. Her own hair was already tied away from her face, all the better to see you with, my dear, and her needle wand glinted in her hand. They had gone down the small hilllands to the lake shore. Wrong choice. Running in a forest is difficult, but the trees offer much more cover. In the distance, Draco and Harry could now see 2 figures, 1 male, 1 female, carrying a 3rd small one, and if that was a child and something happens to him, they would burn the forest and dry the lake. Don't let anything happen to that child. Draco grabbed one of the pouches from his belt, cherry wood shaved from a chiffonier, and a tiny piece of unicorn horn taken from a hairbrush. Good responsive materials. The trick to defeating a dark wizard or witch is to be very quick. They are bigger than you, except that from the start. They're better at combat, their casting is stronger, and their knowledge deep and wide. They are willing to do things that you will never do, so they have the advantage. They can inflict more damage than what you can handle. You will be harmed as soon as the duel starts, and there won't be much that you can do afterwards.
I don't suppose you brought a comb with you, whispered Draco.
Harry, his hair in an insultingly messy bun, said no with his head. Draco resisted the temptation to bury his hands in the hair and straighten it or something. Such hair he had, it was so very black and messy, and he shouldn't be thinking about it right now. Merlin.
All right, then.
No comb, no magic cage. They would do something else. They ran parallel to the lake shore, but still hidden by the trees until they caught up with the Death Eaters. The fleeing woman was now holding the child while the man drew his wand.
Keep running,
they heard him say, followed by 2 weak Protegos and a Stupefy. The spells weren't particularly powerful, but he was quick with them. Maybe he could buy the woman enough time to get away. Draco liked Stupefy because it was a very useful spell in its simplicity. You cast it and the victim would drop unconscious. But unfortunately, people were becoming more and more adept at fighting its effects. The man hit by the spell barely stumbled before shaking himself back to his senses. Cherry and Unicorn weren't materials suited for fighting, too soft and benevolent, but they weren't a bad combination if you thought about it as a suggestion to send someone to sleep rather than as a dueling move. Draco pointed his fist at the closest Death Eater while he stepped away from the cover of the trees. He extended the movement with his open palm facing up. There was a sizzling sound, and the Death Eater fell down. Huzzah for Draco, everybody. Draco took another pouch, rosewood and dragon scales, and set the woman's robes on fire. He had no idea of who she was, but one look at her face with the deep shadows under the pale blue eyes was enough to know she was one of the Core. One of the old and mean and most devoted followers, one of the really mad ones that preferred Azkaban over denying their loyalty to Voldemort. A nasty one, Voldemort had rewarded their loyalty with dark secrets unknown to the other followers. Her robes had barely burned before she extinguished the flames. Not even a water charm like Umbridge had to use so often during the riots. The fire was simply gone, and she was turning to Draco, who was scrambling to get one of the good bags out of the bandolier, oak and ash and old iron rubbed over his gloved hands. Her curse sent Draco flying 3 meters back, but he was alive and only a bit sore. His silent Protego had been strong enough, and in the meantime, the other wizard had used the distraction to cast spell after spell, and in a bit of mad good luck, had managed to cast Locomotor Wibbly on one of the Death Eaters who was now jumping up and down to the shore.
Expelliarmus!
Cried Draco, burning his bag of walnut and troll blood. The jumping Death Eater dropped his wand, and that meant there was just another wizard, and the really scary witch, and Harry could join the fight whenever he felt like it. No need to wait for an invitation. Anyone would be good.
Protego! Incendio Babilius Reducto!
Said the poor wizard. He sounded tired, very tired, and his voice was hoarse, but he kept casting anything that came to his mind. From his wand erupted flames, a bright yellow bolt that was a bit blinding, and then a blue-black line that didn't hit anyone and was lost in the water. It wasn't a bad technique, as stupid as it looked. The Death Eaters were used to fighting Aurors and adult wizards. This mad succession of spells was unusual, and it worked in keeping them distracted and second-guessing, enough that Draco could get Hawthorn and Leather, from the broken punishment switch, so blood-soaked leather, and cast Bombarda and sent everyone to the floor. Ha 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 ha! Kiss the dust. The woman rolled and jumped back to her feet with animal speed and fluidity. Her long mane of dirty blonde hair moved after her like the tail of a forest creature. Like the fox or the marten, she made a zigzagging motion with her wand, slashing the air and leaving purple lines behind, and Draco found himself on the ground and short of breath, blinking. He saw his right arm was covered with blood, and he felt a certain numbness extending from his chest to his arms, but he didn't stop to think about it, and he wouldn't even notice that he had 5 deep bleeding gashes on him until much later. You can thank adrenaline for this. All he knew was that he had used 5 wand pouches already, and that woman was impervious to everything. Another motion from her wand, and the poor wizard they were trying to help went down in a flash of red light. Not a stupefy, though. You don't scream like that with the stunning spell. It felt like the moment was made of silence, although it was actually filled with screams. But it felt silent and quiet, because suddenly they were both on the ground, that poor wizard and him, and she was standing, and she could allow herself to go slowly, take her time, and savor it.
"And who are you that you dare come between the Dark Lord's servants and their mission?"
She had a deep voice that could have been beautiful in song were she capable of such a thing. She probably wasn't. She didn't seem like someone who could understand music.
"You will answer me, and I will kill you last. The mudblood goes first."
Draco, being Draco, ignored this and wondered about what had happened to the 3rd Death Eater. The first one was unconscious and hopefully would remain so for a while. He could still hear the second one jumping and cursing them to the 7 hells, but the other he didn't know if he had been hit with the explosive curse or not. Not that it mattered much, because that woman was about to kill both of them, but still Draco wondered. Draco was a big-picture kind of guy. The muggle-born wizard was telling the woman what she could do with her prejudice and her person, which involved putting one inside the other. His voice was a bit familiar, but he was gasping, and Draco felt a bit dizzy, so who knew? Maybe we all sound the same when we are about to die.
"Crucio,"
said the witch, followed by a new list of colorful expletives from the wizard. She was not the only one with feline grace, and the wizard had rolled away from her curse, good for him. Maybe then Draco would have time to get another wand bag out. There seemed to be a problem with them. Draco got on his knees, ignoring the nausea he felt it moving and the woozy feeling, and looked down at his hand. The gloves were stained. One could even go so far as to say drenched with blood, but other than that, his hands were not trembling. Yet he felt an odd tingling on the tips of his fingers, and for some reason he couldn't grab the strings that closed the little pouches.
"Eat poison and die, fartface,"
said someone in the background, probably the Muggleborn. Must be the gloves, Draco decided. The gloves were the problem. He bit on his index finger and tongued to remove it. Just one hand, 1 free hand to get another wand, and he would put the willow bark and acromantula hair on his right hand, and then he would make a spiral with a long tail and cast Expelliarmus, and everything would be right. Well, he still didn't know what had happened to that other wizard. He couldn't forget about him once he disarmed the witch, because he would. He was going to disarm her. He was. Look at him. First the witch, and then the other one.
"Avada Kedavra!"
screamed the woman as she was hit with a tree branch. The tree line was well over 40 steps behind them. yet she had just been knocked aside by a branch.
"Alicia, help me!"
said a voice coming from the tree that was suddenly standing there in the middle of the land between the lake and the forest. The tree shook his branches again and knocked the witch once more. She had blood on her face, tightened her grip on her wand as she stared at the flailing tree, one of those thin ones with the white bark and leaves that sometimes look silver or gold, a pretty but strange tree.
"Help!"
whispered the tree. "Birch." It was a birch, and there was a face in his trunk, and he extended his branches toward Alicia, who understandably had forgotten all about Draco and the other guy, probably because she was confronted by the unusual vision of one of her colleagues transforming into a freaking tree before her own eyes. The best part was when she raised her wand and screamed Incendio, but she got nothing because her wand and hand had disappeared, and she now had, instead, her very own tree branch. She screamed and shook it and knocked at it with her left hand that soon started to sport a rough, dark bark. She twisted and contorted and screamed, and by the time Draco had pushed himself back to his feet, Alicia was two-thirds a willow tree. The wind shook their leaves. Harry was standing behind them, both hands extended in the air and an expression of concentration and quiet, controlled fury. He had removed his hair tie and used it to keep his wand on his forearm. His long hair, black and untamed, danced around his face, and in that instant, he looked more like Merlin than any other depiction ever had. He looked like Morgana, too, like a forgotten god of the forest, like the old magic, the raw magic. He looked like someone you would hate and fear and love. The effect was dissipated by the glasses, though. When all they could hear from the witch was the susurrus of her leaves in the wind, and Harry finally lowered his hands, Draco was still staring at him. The mad, wonderful boy who fought everyone and turned the bad people into trees and wondered at the name of the stars. Harry.
Technically, Harry hadn't turned the two Death Eaters into trees. What he'd done was trap them inside their wands for an undefined period of time because he didn't know how long it would last. He thought he should now do something about the third Death Eater who had jumped his way to the lake and back twice already, and he still couldn't get his wand for the ground. And they said first-tier magic was useless. But Draco was staring at him with an intense gaze that felt like a stab on Harry's chest. Draco was covered in blood and looking at him with the moon shining from his stupid eyes. Draco was staring and bleeding and walking towards him intently. Draco took Harry's face in his hands, blood-stained fingers splaying on his cheeks, and kissed him. A good kiss, too, sweet and hot and full of passion, and perhaps a bit of irritation at Harry being Harry. Harry, who was oblivious and absent-minded but not dense, not at all, grabbed Draco's shoulders and held on until Draco ended the kiss for lack of air and took a step back, panting. And even then, Harry kept his hands on Draco's arms, and Draco kept looking at him as if all the secrets of the universe were written in Harry's eyes. It was mad. They were all mad. There were two murderers transformed into vegetation, and a third one jumping in the background and tripping over the unconscious body of a fourth Death Eater they had all forgotten about. There was death, and there was sunlight, and Harry could still feel Draco's lips over his own. Draco's lips were not plump, nor full, but they were very pink. The best kind of pink. Then came Dean, because it was Dean, dear Merlin, Dean Thomas, so kind and funny and open-minded and so close to death right now. He had been so close. Dean seemed to think this was a thing they were doing, and he was probably mad with relief, too, so he sent one last jinx in the direction of the jumping Death Eater before taking a hold of the back of Harry's head and planting a kiss. Not as good as Draco's, but a good kiss nonetheless, points for enthusiasm and technique. No real complaints here. Dean was very hot, even under present circumstances.
"It's so good to see you!"
cried Dean after he broke the kiss and hugged Harry. And yes, Harry agreed it was good to see him. Harry patted him on the shoulder and took the chance to take some deep breaths. He was very short of breath.
"Draco!"
Dean went on. He had a big, beautiful smile on his face and tears in his eyes.
"No! No! No!"
There was a definite possibility that Dean had been confounded. Or maybe it was just the rush of adrenaline and general excitement for not dying. Harry got it the first time he didn't die, and he was awake right after. He also found it very exciting. Dean was now kissing a protesting Draco and dipping him, which, an interesting image that Harry was keeping for later.
"Dear Merlin, Thomas!"
sputtered Draco when he was upright once more. When Hermione arrived, not long after, she was thoroughly kissed too, even though Dean ought to have gotten a hold of himself by then. She blushed awfully and looked a bit flustered, but not so much that she couldn't cast a stunning spell that sent the jumping Death Eater flying away from his wand. Awful man, but his tenacity ought to be commended. Since Draco was pink and looked completely lost and a bit wild, and Dean was still crying and laughing and hugging them, Hermione ended up looking like the only one in control. Harry had a hold of himself, but he hadn't looked self-possessed a day in his life. Luna had the same problem. He wanted to blame the hair. Harry had no problem admitting Hermione was a superior being and the ultimate adult supervision. She sent Harry to take the wands from the unconscious Death Eaters and ordered Draco to take his shirt off. Excellent order. She should give it more often. Draco looked in bemusement at the 5 bleeding cuts that crisscrossed his chest and arms. "Oh," he said. "It hurts when I look at it." "Then look at Harry, will you? You're probably in shock. Sit here." Draco did as he was told, while Hermione rummaged in her bag and got a bottle of Dittany to clean and close the wounds. The flesh healed quickly and without blemish, so at least they knew they were not cursed wounds. Next was Dean, who was dizzy and hurt and exhausted and alternating laughing with crying. Harry sat next to him and held his hand while Hermione tried a couple of healing spells. The thing that helped the most was giving him a bottle of water, though. He was a bit dehydrated. And then they went on. It was still a sunny and beautiful day, and it was still full of death. This is the thing about life. You don't get to skip the ugly and pedestrian parts. You don't get to skip the part when you have to pick up. And healing always takes longer than hurting. There was much to do. They left the 2 non-transformed Death Eaters under the birch tree, bound and gagged and without their wands. They were both unconscious now, but one of them kept kicking madly even in his sleep. A little while later, the woman that was running with Dean came back to see what had happened. She was a squib by the name of Peoria, and she was looking just as exhausted as Dean. It turned out that the small figure they had seen wasn't a child, but a goblin called Griphook. He had injured his legs badly and couldn't run, hence why they had been carrying him. It would take a while until he was fixed, and they didn't have Skellagrow. But as soon as Hermione gave him a quick remedy for the pain, he wobbled to the willow tree despite her protestations that he should rest. Griphook closed his long, knobbly fingers around a low branch, and after taking a breath, he snapped it. They all flinched at the crack of wood, but no one said anything. Instead, they walked slowly back to the forest. There was a smoking circle, free of trees and vegetation, with a big black gooey pile of something a bit off-center, and a lonely pair of leather boots. Hermione went by without a second glance, and no one dared ask her. Just like with Griphook, no one felt like they had the right to say anything. The dead man was called James, and he was a muggle and a proud father of 2 Ravenclaw girls. He had taken care of all of them as they went into hiding. Dean told them that many people had had to run, but if you didn't find a safe place to hide, running only took you so far. They had met James at a safe house that was attacked by snatchers, and they only got out thanks to Dean's magic and James's resourcefulness. And now he was dead. It was still hours until Creature came for them. They gave their lunch to the rescued trio and to Draco, who was looking a bit paler than usual and had to be told to sit for a while. The wounds may have closed, but his clothes were still wet with his own blood. Harry and Hermione went and found a big nice tree under which they could bury that poor muggle called James. Not just any tree, but a beautiful one. Hermione could be trusted to pack all kinds of supplies in her bag, and so she found a spare shirt that they used to shroud James's face. He shouldn't have dirt on his face. Somehow Draco had ended up holding all the captured wands, prompted because he was the one carrying more pockets, so he had the 2 from the Death Eaters by the lake and 3 taken by Hermione. Griphook, the goblin, asked to keep one of them. "Wand use is restricted to humans," said Draco matter-of-factly before engaging in a thankfully brief speech about control and the power restrictions imposed by the elite, all while he examined the captured wands with the same careful and critical eye of Ollivander. "Here, walnut and dragon heartstring. Not the best for delicate work, but powerful and solid." The goblin accepted the proffered wand silently, and perhaps trying to cover his surprise at having gotten away with his request. Wands were restricted to humans, and lately only to those who could prove pure blood status up to 4 generations from both sides. Dean Thomas was grinning as if he couldn't think of a better spectacle. The other wands were broken in 3 pieces and buried at the feet of the muggle called James. No one was sure on how to spell his surname, so they only carved a big J on a stone put at the head of the grave. Harry promised to himself that he would find his daughters and show them the grave so they could take him back,
just as he had promised to one day retrieve Regulus Black's body. They invited them to return to the house, of course, but to their surprise they refused. Griphook thought they could go to a goblin safe house, and he said he would speak for Peoria and Dean. Goblins didn't like wizards or humans, and Griphook was no exception, but in the last 48 hours he had been saved by a muggle, helped by a squib, seen a muggle-born wizard stay behind to protect them, and finally met an insane pureblood who handed him a wand. He was a bit more willing to accept that this was not a species conflict. "It will probably be safer, anyway," said the girl, Peoria. She had a funny smile, with a gap in her front teeth that made her instantly likable. "No offense, but you aren't Harry Potter. In the best of cases, we'll slay you down." The matter was settled. It was pointless, they said, to follow Harry and the others around, especially when only Dean could do proper magic. Besides, Dean took his position as secretary of the Platform for Race, Blood, and Species Equality very seriously. And didn't someone say to keep fighting, Draco? It would be good, he argued, if he could get people working together. They had seen them. They knew they were alive, and they knew they were working together, doing what they didn't know and weren't about to ask. But just being able to say that they had seen Harry, Draco, and Hermione, and that they were fighting Voldemort would give hope to others and help them work together.
Voldemort? You haven't heard? They put a taboo in the name. Pronouncing it brings Death Eaters to your location.
Harry's eyes gleamed. Hermione elbowed him with the word no already on her lips. No, they were not going to the top of a volcano and saying the name there to see what happened.
We were calling him V, said Peoria. But it kind of sounds like a euphemism for vagina, and I don't know, it was awkward.
I can't believe how many people want V back, said Dean with a pathetic attempt at a serious face.
I knew V had followers, but this is unexpected. I never would have pegged him as someone who wanted V.
It certainly left room for interpretation.
You should call him Tom, said Harry, who for some reason had now multiple leaves tangled in his hair and a female robin perched on top.
That's his real name, not even Thomas. Tom. Tom Marvolo Riddle.
Why would he change to Voldemort?
Peoria stopped herself quickly.
Why would he drop the riddle?
That's exactly what I've been saying,
exclaimed Hermione. So they didn't return with them, but it was a very good meeting, nevertheless. Creature didn't want to take them, though. Creature, when he arrived, started to shake as soon as he saw that Draco had been injured. But they managed to calm him down and swore they would all wait safely tucked away while he apparated Griphook and Peoria and Dean to a small village south of Oxford. Still, he didn't start to relax until an hour after he brought them home, and he tried to keep Draco's bloody shirt. It had been a beautiful day, warm and sunny, and Harry had gotten a kiss. Two, actually, but he could not stop thinking about one of them. It was also a day in which a good man had died, and many others had come close to it, and the normalcy and safety of the house felt surreal. They were covered in grime and sweat, and in Draco's case, blood. They took turns washing in the second-floor bathroom. The shower worked better on that one, because sometimes cleaning spells are not enough to make you feel really clean. After that, they all trudged upstairs, feeling drained. Hermione went to her room, and she didn't even close the door behind her before falling down on top of the bed, so tired she was. Harry and Draco went to the room that had become theirs even though summer came weeks ago, and they could not use the excuse of the cold anymore. That night, as they undressed slowly and tiredly, it was Harry's turn to take Draco's hands and look at his chest, pale and unblemished. There was no trace of the deep bleeding gashes that had crossed it, no trace at all, but still Harry remembered exactly the location of the cuts. He knew the place where there ought to be a scar. He put his hand on Draco's chest, under the breastbone, and moved it slowly down until he found his beating heart. Under his fingers there was solid flesh and soft skin, not even the blood that had stained his clothes.
"Does it hurt?" Harry asked, eyes fixed on his fingers. "Maybe it's swollen or bruised."
"No, it's fine. It didn't even hurt then. I didn't notice."
Harry nodded.
"Good, that's good."
They would forever claim that it was Harry who leaned forward and took Draco's mouth with his own, but if Draco had already been moving, it didn't really matter. It was a simple kiss, soft and gentle. It felt like drinking cold water in the heat. You had to go slow so you wouldn't be hurt. You had to go slow and relish it. After that kiss, many others followed. Easy and natural, like holding hands when stepping inside a big, cold, hostile house. Like napping and sleeping together to keep their worst fears and the loneliness away. Like flying together and fighting together and cooking and bickering. It felt natural and it felt right, and they kissed and kissed that night while holding hands.
given that Mr. Weasley is already an adult, I hardly think your presence will be necessary, Mr. Weasley.
On the contrary, Bill thought his presence was very necessary because he did not trust the Ministry at all when they said they only wanted to ask Ron some questions. He understood they weren't in a position to say no, especially after that business with the twins, but if Ron had to do it, then Bill wanted to be there and make sure nobody touched a single hair on his head. Only they were quite opposed to letting him be present during the interrogation, which made him even more adamant that he should be there. Ron, thankfully, was saying nothing, but he had asked Bill if he thought that they would give him Veritaserum, and he probably thought Bill didn't notice, but he had a piece of the twins' special gum in his hands. Bill was sure that Ron couldn't say anything useful about Harry or the twins. It was all a waste of time, and Ron had no reason to be worried except for how his lack of collaboration and that stupid piece of gum made him look like he had a lot to say about the topic. It is not what you know, it is about what they think you know and what they will do to make you talk. He should really take that gum away before Ron ate it.
Is there a problem, Cecilius?
There was a time when Bill would have been relieved at seeing his brother Percy, when he would have smiled and maybe teased him a bit about his work in the Ministry, but he would still have been relieved and grateful that Perse, good old Perse, with his high position in the Ministry, had come, because he was sure that he would help them out of this mess. Now was not the time when Bill could think that. There was no relief.
Mr. Weasley,
said the Ministry officer, a middle-aged man who looked and acted eerily like Percy,
Mr. Weasley here has concerns about the request of an informational interview with Mr. Weasley.
Dear Merlin, how could anyone utter such a sentence and mean it? Yet the man spoke as if there were nothing humorous whatsoever in his phrasing, and Percy looked equally serious.
Oh, dear.
Percy managed to sound as if he had just caught someone before they misfiled something.
I'm afraid that on this occasion, William is right. Ronnie can be so uncooperative.
It is often so with the younger siblings, I'm afraid. Always spoiled.
No, that's not...
Thank you, Cecilius. I will take it from there. Percy interrupted, and it was only then that Bill realized how powerful little Percy was, how high and deep in the structure of the Ministry that he could actually order people around and dismiss their words. Bill was the eldest. He remembered when Percy had to be potty-trained. Of course, he never stopped thinking of his brother as that little curly-haired freckled boy who somehow managed to keep a shrieking frog as a pet for 2 months without anyone discovering him. Percy dropped his hand, narrow and long-fingered like Bill's, like Jenny's, on the back of Ron's neck.
I will make sure Ronnie is at his most cooperative.
He extended the other hand palm up, white and almost feminine. Cecilius only hesitated a second before handing over the clipboard with the papers. Just like in the station, Percy nodded at Bill coldly.
William,
he said. His hands tightened on Ron's neck, pushing him into motion. Ron was almost Bill's height, almost Percy's height, and he was being quiet, 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 because he was only a 17-year-old boy, about to be pressed into giving information on his best friend. I taught you how to hold a wand, Bill wanted to scream, because he had. Yes, their mother taught them how to read and write and tell the hours, but Bill was the one who taught the others how to hold a wand, just like Charlie was the one who taught them how to fly a broom. Bill taught him how to hold a wand and how to operate, when against all expectations, Percy turned out to have trouble with it. It was almost as if he didn't know where he was at any given time, let alone where to go. Bill had done all that, and he couldn't believe that Percy would choose himself and his career before his family. That he would sacrifice Ron just like that. But there wasn't much that Bill could do, standing there in the atrium. Or there was, which was even worse, because Bill would have no trouble cursing Percy and sending him to the floor, and he could stop any spell they sent his way. He could fight his way out of this situation, he was certain of that, grab Ron and run. But that would only get them as far as outside the building. What then? What about Ginny and Fleur back home? They had requested to interrogate Ginny too, but thank Merlin, she was still under 17, and he had been able to say no. Dear Merlin, if he hadn't agreed to taking them at the beginning of summer, if he had decided to leave them with Percy, and he had stayed with Fleur in their beautiful small apartment, Percy would have been the one in the position to say no. And he wouldn't have. He would have given them their little sister, just as he was now sending their baby brother down. Fenrir Greyback had acted on his own, or so they would say. Fenrir Greyback had let himself into Bill Weasley's apartment on the evening of a full moon, but Bill wasn't there. He was waiting for his brother Ron to be released from the Ministry, and in the meantime he had taken his sister to go get some ice cream because that was all he could do at the time to make her and him feel better. That was all right for Fenrir. Killing and maiming the three weasels would certainly be praised in Death Eater circles, and he still intended to do it, but he had actually come for the girl. The beautiful girl with milky skin and rose petal lips. She was taking a shower. By the time she came out, Fenrir would have already transformed. A pity that he didn't remember well what happened during transformations, because he would like to remember this. The taste of her blood on her flesh, her screams as he tore at her. Her white skin would look very pretty with the bright blood running down. Fenrir thought that he would also get the Weasleys when they returned home, and with a bit of luck, the man would see what he had done to his lovely little girlfriend. Fenrir would like that. Werewolves were pretty much animals. Everybody knew that, so there was hardly anything to investigate. The werewolf saw the opportunity and acted on instinct, and certainly not because of any political agenda. Besides, they should have known better than leaving a half-vila alone in the house. How irresponsible. They were pretty much asking for something to happen. They even had a window open. Clearly the werewolf got a drift of her smell through the open window and thus acted on it. They had no one to blame except themselves. So the apartment was on the fifth floor. Still, they were asking for it, leaving the girl there, and who was to say that she hadn't invited him in? That was Vila's, you know. They liked it. They wanted it. They were always trying to entice men. Maybe she did, and maybe this time she found that the man she was toying with was much more than she could handle. The officials investigating the case didn't have a pre-written report of what happened, but they could just as well. The case was clear. First of all, Fleur Delacour was not a Vila. She was not even half Vila. She was a quarter Vila, and really tired of having to explain this. Not that it did any good, because people never listened. Harry did, but nobody listened to him when he said werewolves were not mindless beasts. In Fleur's experience, men were divided in three categories. First were the ones who got all nervous and flustered and acted like bumbling idiots, embarrassing themselves and everyone else in the room who was subjected to the pathetic spectacle. Then there were the ones who had a bit more control over themselves and were pathetic in a different way. They unfailingly tried to impress her, usually by behaving like total jerks who knew everything and could do everything, and were so much better than Fleur. And she should obviously fall to her knees and worship these great men, or suck their cocks, or both. Lastly, there was the sadly small group of men that were not interested in her. Some gay, some asexual, some with too much sense of ridicule, and a few who were so deeply in love that were blind to her charm. Crumb had been pretty decent. So was Harry, but he was a child. Poor Diggory blushed a lot around her, but he managed not to make her uncomfortable. With women, Fleur only knew jealousy and viciousness and occasionally some attraction. They were usually much sweeter, the girls that went after her, but still too similar to the boys in what they wanted. Then there was Bill. Sneaky, slippery Bill, who couldn't be categorized. For her first month during her internship in Gringotts, Fleur had thought he was gay. Bill didn't offer to help her with her English like every other male human staff in the bank did, and about half of the clients. But he did offer to help her with the culture and the pragmatic aspects of settling in. He told her where to buy groceries and how to take her tea, and he walked her around Diagon Alley showing her the shops and didn't try to kiss her at all. He touched her arm a couple of times, but he didn't blush or stammer. He simply did it to bring her attention to something. Fleur noticed that Bill had a beautiful smile and that when he spoke, he looked her in the eye. They moved in together. It was convenient for both of them and less expensive. Bill had demonstrated to be able to work and live around her without making a fool of himself, and Fleur was happy, a nice gay friend to help her while she lived in a foreign country, someone who treated her like a person rather than a fantasy. Still, sometimes Fleur wished that someone someday would be able to treat her like a woman. Not the sex dream and not the sexless friend, but a woman made of flesh and hair, rather than silk and gold or whatever stupid metaphor they came up with, but that was idle thinking, and she knew it couldn't be. In the meantime, Fleur took the friend she had and counted herself lucky for having met someone as nice as William Weasley, who, by the way, never showed any interest in dating anyone. She thought he might be asexual, and wasn't that funny? The asexual man in the half-villa sharing quarters. And he was a fine man, Bill Weasley. C'est bon temps. There must have been a lot of people frustrated by his disinterest. Fleur didn't realize that it was a pity that such a handsome man remained single, because it was exactly the same kind of thinking they applied to her, and it hurt. Fleur, such a beautiful girl, I wonder who she will marry, what will her kids look like? As if she weren't a champion witch, a curse breaker. Someone who learned a second language and took the big brave step of going to another country. It hurt, and she wouldn't do that to another. But when Bill smiled at her, she saw fire in the corner of his lips. And damn, it was a pity that no one was getting to kiss that fire. Then one rainy Tuesday afternoon, like any other morning in that stupid wet country, someone brought an old broken coffer, and they got into an hours-long argument about the best method to break a triplication curse. The argument took all of their morning and extended until lunch, and she saw his eyes shine and darken with pleasure, and she didn't know, she didn't know. This continued for a few months, rainy and windy months, during which they were professional, but also friendly to each other and absolutely nothing else, despite the knowing smirks of their co-workers, that is, until they accidentally brought up the topic of curse decay in fabrics, which started a 3-day-long argument in which they both refused to concede their point because it somehow became a matter of personal, scholarly, and patriotic pride. The argument was never officially settled, but somehow on Sunday afternoon, it led to Bill shagging her spectacularly on the kitchen counter and the couch, and eventually one of the bedrooms, where Bill buried his face between Fleur's legs and declared this was the place where he wanted to die, only he made it sound very poetic. Now, do you look at that? Not asexual after all, just laid back and respectful, and so used to living in close quarters with lots of people, at home and school in the program in Egypt, that Bill had acquired an amazing mastery of his libido. He was probably demisexual or something like that. Fleur had read a lot about sexuality out of necessity, but she wasn't overly concerned with the definition. She was quite enamored of him. She was also, in case this was not clear, so much more than a pretty villa. This was the point. She was more than a pretty face, and Bill knew that. He saw that. The man shagging her was also the man who remembered that Fleur was a threat assessor of cursed objects at Gringotts and champion of her school in the Triwizard Tournament. She did not need to have her wand at hand to repel the initial attack of the werewolf. The monster didn't even get close to her, honestly. If they could see that she had inherited her grandmother's villa beauty, why would they think she didn't get the whole package? Like the bird face when she grew angry, or the fact that villa could throw fireballs out of their hands. Of course, those who make this mistake rarely get the chance to tell others about it. Today was not Fenrir Greyback's lucky day, but neither was it Fleur's, because Bill returned home sooner than expected. When the door opened, the werewolf lashed out, trying to make an exit, and clawed at Bill's face and shoulder. He didn't get to do more than that, because by then Fleur had her wand in hand, and she hit him twice with a spell. The creature ran away, leaving behind the smell of blood and burned hair. They spent the night in St. Mungo's, Fleur and Ginevra, later joined by Ronald, whose interview at the Ministry had to hurriedly come to an end once they heard about the attack. They stayed there, sitting side by side on the stone bench on the corner, and when they heard that Bill hadn't been infected and that he would keep his eye, they hugged long and tight. Fleur knew that on that day, finally, the wall between her and the annoying sister had started to fall. On that day, they came together. Draco did not taste like lemons, and the skin of his neck and under his ear did not have a hint of orchids, and his hair certainly did not give off a faint smell of honeysuckle. Draco was a person, and so he smelled like one. That didn't mean that Harry didn't feel the lemon, the orchid, and the honeysuckle all the same. They were there even if they were not. This was a thought that made sense. Draco.
Mm-hmm.
Draco's face was currently buried in the space between Harry's neck and shoulder, and it was a wonder he was not suffocating with all the hair.
I realize this is a weird question.
Harry felt Draco's shoulders and back ripple with laughter. Harry also realized this was a rich statement coming from him. Just for that, he turned his head a little bit and kissed the crown of Draco's head. There was much of Draco he hadn't kissed yet. There was much he hadn't done, but for now it seemed like they couldn't jump to the next stage when they were not done kissing yet.
Are you part Vila?
There was a snort as Draco came up for air, resting his weight on his elbows. He smiled with a mouth that still had thin lips of a lovely pink. Many men could get lost and do something foolish because of that shade of pink. Women, too, or so Harry thought. Side note, he would like to reread the Odyssey.
Late,
Draco said, clearly amused.
Late for what?
Too late for that question. He shifted a bit and pushed Harry's hair away before dropping next to him, both of their heads on the same pillow.
The Quidditch World Cup had Vila, and absolutely everyone in Hogwarts got into their heads that I had to be one too. And then, of course, they saw me talking with Derek Kerr, and never mind that I'm the only one in Hogwarts who speaks decent French. We had to be talking about Vila things, obviously.
Harry stared at his mouth. It could be true. He was certainly feeling things he hadn't felt with Fleur.
I'm just blonde, pointed out Draco.
You're very pretty in any case. And to prove that, Harry kissed his cheek.
You know the Weasley twins tried to steal my hair and sell it to Ollivander for wand cause, Draco muttered while he shifted position to fall asleep. He doesn't even use Vila hair. What I can't understand is why nobody thought that Lovegood could be part Vila. Oh my god, muttered Hermione, tiredly dropping the sugar in her tea mug. Draco, please, not you too. I don't see why I could be one but not her. The things you make me hear. It had been Harry's birthday, and it had gone without celebrating. The skip only becoming obvious now when the date of Hermione's birthday came closer and closer, and Harry began to think about baking her some special dessert. It had been Harry's birthday, and they hadn't celebrated, but after last year's, and after the one when he turned 11, Harry had grown weary of birthdays. Draco and Hermione had known without being told, and so they went over that day. And the week before, and the week after that, like thieves melting with the shadows, careful not to do anything that would bring disaster. Now it was September. Now it felt as if the danger had passed, a curse averted until the next year. Now Harry could receive a birthday present in the form of a kiss. And just in case the curse was still active, Draco hid the kiss between hundreds more so that no one would be able to tell which one was it. End of chapter 9.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.